So my name is Pearl Gluck, and I'm 33 years old. Today is November 26, 2005. We're at Grand Central Terminal, and I'm speaking to my soulmate and friend, Aaron Taub.
My name is Yirmiyahu Aaron Taub. I'm 38 years old. Today is November 26th, 2005. We are at Grand Central Terminal, and I'm speaking with Pearl Gluck, my friend.
So, Aaron, do you remember when we met?
I do, Pearl.
I don't think I've ever asked you, like, if you really remember, like, the first time you met me.
Why don't you recount the originary narrative?
The original narrative. it takes me back to, I don't know if you knew this, but I was an editor or associate editor or whatever at Tikkun magazine, which was a Jewish magazine in New York, now moved to California through Michael Lerner. And I met this incredible guy. It just blew my mind because I had just come. I mean, I came from college, but originally from the Hasidic world. So there's very little of the complexity of New York society that I really knew. And in walks this guy with like long hair, you know, always like me, with always with my bag on my back. He always had his bike on his back. He was an anarchist, a New York anarchist. You know, he's the guy who was involved with the whole squatter issue. I think you remember in the early 90s. So his name's Eric Goldhagen. And he's the kind of guy that like any editor of any magazine would love to hate, but needs desperately for so many reasons. And I think Eric loved that, you know, that he could really just stand for everything he stood for. So one of the things he introduced me to was that kind of Lower East Side, early Williamsburg scene of art. And so he invited me to a party that was kind of it was not a party. It was like a public art action, which I think was done by a friend of yours.
Erin McGonigal was involved with it.
Yeah, and I didn't know her at the time yet. And then you introduced me to her much later. So I go with him to this event, which just blew my mind. I just loved it. And it really spoke to me in so many ways because I really didn't understand the language. And so I enjoyed it the way you understand a language you don't... the way you enjoy a language you don't understand. It was like poetry.
And it was an old railroad building.
Yeah.
Kind of hollowed out, empty.
What was it?
There was like stone paths everywhere. Candles everywhere.
Candles. And there was like a dance event.
I think movement.
There was movement. Right, sorry, not dance. And that's too much of a category. And they really were beyond category that night. I think it was an auto repair, an ex-auto repair shop or something. Because there were like these tracks on the floors. But you weren't there.
I was there.
You were there?
Mm-hmm.
Wow.
I was there, unseen.
I didn't meet you that night.
Mm. So
instead,
when did you meet me?
Instead, the person I met was the guy Lloyd, remember? I was walking down this long hallway, and walking toward me is this kind of Adonis-like character. I was drinking, so he looked like Adonis to me at the time.
He was very handsome.
He was handsome,
in
yeah.
His way.
Yeah, and along with him came my memory of his truck. He had an excellent truck. He had driven me home from college once, so I remembered him from Brandeis. And we started to talk, and I was like, yeah, you know, I had a mad crush on this guy, and it looked like it was mutual at the time, so we went out and, like, threw rocks into the water. The East River, I guess, is what it was, right? It's the East River that separates Manhattan from what is now highly gentrified and very sad to see Williamsburg. Anyway, so there we were, throwing rocks into the water and chatting, and he asked me what I did, and at the time I was fiction and poetry editor of Response magazine, remember?
A contemporary Jewish review.
Yes.
Response.
Yeah. And he said, oh, my roommate's a poet. I said, who's your roommate? And he said, Aaron? I'm like, Aaron Taub. Yirmiyahu Aaron Taub. And I had just had a phone conversation with you just a couple days before that about your poem, which was just so beautiful. And I don't know if you remember that conversation.
I don't remember the conversation. I think this narrative kind of changes every time you tell it, but I love it.
Isn't that great?
I love it.
you should
always
keep me
new
real.
Details added.
Which is such a sign of...
I don't think
of,
there was a conversation.
That's who
point.
We really are, Aaron. Like, you are the kind
it's
of...
It's very rare that poetry editors speak to poets that submit work.
You said that on the phone.
Yeah.
And I think you told me at the time you enjoyed the conversation, and that was good. I think we took out a couple of lines, or you explained why something was there. We might have moved something, or we didn't, but we talked about it. And I just loved your work. And so when he told me that, I was like, oh, wow, this is great. You know, fast forward, was it 2 months later? You'll find me and you sitting in the kitchen at 3 a.m. when there should be pillow talk between me and my then lover. And instead, there was me and you in the kitchen chatting into the night, which, by the way, is very rare for you to be up that late.
I was going to say it's highly unlikely that I was up at 3 a.m, but go with it.
It was post-coital, so maybe it was an early evening.
This is all about the creation of myth, which is brilliant.
This is all about how Lloyd and I haven't seen each other in how many years, and you and I have become fast friends since.
So this is our 10-year anniversary, Pearl.
It is?
Yeah.
This?
1995 to 2005.
Wow.
Definitely. What a great way to celebrate.
Mazel tov.
Mazel tov to you.
But it's true. I think in a way, it's like you've always kept me. You are, to me, what it would have been nice for the Vilna Gaon to have been to early Hasidim. Like that kind of, that really upset you that I just said
No. Wow.
Because Hasidim were just kind of the more passionate, off-kilter, seemingly off-kilter, you know, tree-hugging liberals. And the Vilna Gaon was like, was it the Vilna? It was the Vilna Gaon.
The Vilna Gaon was a strong critic of Hasidism.
Yeah. And your background is what?
Well, Hasidism itself was a reaction against the kind of rigid legalism of rabbinic Judaism. And it was all about sort of getting back to the land and sort of entering the forest and becoming closer to God through nature. It was about reflection. And in a way, it was radically democratic, although some of that changed later with the formation of dynasties. But the sort of primal Hasidic impulse is that it's not so much about how much Talmud you master, but how close you become to God and the good works that you can do that are, that result from that, what we call dvekas, cleavage with God. But yeah, my background is different. I was raised in the ultra-Orthodox yeshiva world, which in its own way was quite wonderful. There was a lot of singing. There was a lot of dancing as well. It was very Talmudic based. Mm-hmm. So it was very legalistic. And the yeshiva that I went to, the Talmudic Yeshiva of Philadelphia, where my father is a Rebbe, I went there for 2 years. As per the title of the institution, Talmudic Yeshiva focuses on the Talmud and focuses on that rigorous study. So it's a slightly different emphasis. We had Hasidim in our yeshiva, and we still do. Yeah. We still do. But it was a slightly different focus.
I can't imagine them be studying the same yeshiva like back in the 1790s or early 1800s.
Well, it was very politicized back then. And
why do you think they can do it now? Why do you think they can mix?
Because those sharp divisions are sort of less emotional now. Right. And each of those movements, at the time, it wasn't clear like what Hasidism would do and how far it would go. And was it really threatening rabbinic Judaism? And now it's sort of, the divisions have all been kind of mapped out. But yeah, the communities do generally tend to stick together. And
were you being crafted to become a Rebbe, just like your father?
No, I wasn't.
Really?
It was fairly clear that I was not going on that path fairly early on.
How?
I was not model Rebbe material. I just
Why?
Didn't
Your
have it.
Your mind is sharp as a whip.
I didn't have it. I didn't have that.
What's the it that you didn't
the
have?
The kind of that separate mysterious element that makes someone a tzaddik or a gaon or something.
That's so interesting that you say that, because it's the exact opposite of what I think of a Rebbe, which makes sense because of my background. I don't see a Rebbe as separate and mysterious. And in fact, it's the exact opposite. They get, you know, the whole idea is for you to be super close.
Well, I didn't mean the Rebbe is mysterious. I just mean that mysterious element that creates that. I never had it. And I was always sort of a marginal figure, even in the yeshiva world. Like, fairly early on, I was reading novels and literature, and I just...
Which isn't typical.
No, it's not. And the Gemara doesn't really... I mean, I admire it. I admire the sort of elegant legalism of it all, but I don't consider myself to have that kind of mind. So
you were saying the Gemara doesn't what about novels?
I think it's a different... The kind of things that I'm interested in, which are a kind of emotional truth, are not reflected in the language of the Gemara, although they can be deduced. And there are certain parts of the Gemara, such as the Haggadah, the stories,
that's
the narratives.
That's what the stories are,
Yeah, which always interests me more. But that's sort of like the downtime in Gemara. I mean, that's kind of, you know,
that's the relaxing... a commercial break.
Yes, exactly. That's a relaxing moment. So
and somehow, I don't know where we got this message, but we should focus on that. And, you know, here it's like...
I think we were just drawn there.
Yeah.
You know, to the, and it's you are, too. I mean,
very much.
Hasidic storytelling for you.
Well, Gemara was never really laid out for me.
You but, know,
we would never have met, even if we were both brought up exactly the same way. Me being a girl, I'd never be in yeshiva with you.
Right. I mean, your education was completely separate.
Yes, and
correct?
Not with Gemara, which was what? The legal, what's Gemara in English? I never really
Talmud.
Had it. It's the Talmud.
Yeah.
It's the law.
Yeah, and basically. The discussions of the law.
Oral. It's the oral Torah.
Mm-hmm.
Not the written.
Right. So
now
what
written.
Did you study?
I think very similar probably to your background. I mean, you know, obviously there's one Torah. And all Jews study it, but how you do it is different. And in my and so obviously Hasidic men or boys can sit and learn exactly what you were sitting and learning, and probably with the same rigor. The change, the difference of passion versus strictness around the page was much more relevant. I think you just said that back when they were farmers or and couldn't go to yeshiva or so, you know, poverty stricken or peasants or whatever, and they couldn't go to yeshiva, and the rabbis were telling them that's okay. You know, and that, and the Goan was like, no, I mean, not the Goan, but yeah, the those critics of Hasidism were saying...
Misnagdim.
The Misnagdim.
Literally meaning opponents.
Right. They were saying, you know, you can't, that's not enough. You can't, mm-hmm. You have to sit and learn. So the sitting and learning is taking place now in the Hasidish world, but not for girls, obviously. So.
But girls do study.
So we study, totally study. Oh, no, it's crucial that we be learned. And we know
and
how
so you
to,
study what? The Pentateuch, the Torah, the
so
prophets.
We study the Torah, the five books of Moses. As you get older, you're introduced to Nevi'im, which is what? The prophets, right? What's
correct.
Kesuvim? What's that?
The Hagiographa.
The Hagiographa.
Which
leave
are?
It to the librarian, the Hebraica librarian of the Library of Congress to tell me
well,
how to define my own words, which I don't know how to do in
well
English.
It's a fairly well-known term. I mean, that includes the Book of Esther. The
Say
book
it
of
again?
It's a fairly well-known term. It includes the Book of Esther, the Book of Ruth.
Well, what's the word?
Hagiographa?
Hagiographa?
I don't know exactly how to pronounce
Hagiographa.
It.
So that we studied as we get older. And the translation could be in Hebrew if you're like in the upper classes, but otherwise it's in Yiddish because Yiddish is the lingua franca. That's, and I think you were also speaking Yiddish, yeah?
No, I was not.
Not Yiddish. So how come your Yiddish is so great?
Yiddish was in the air. The Rosh Hashiva gave drashas in Yiddish.
Which are the speeches.
The speeches.
Moral
correct.
Speeches.
Right, exactly. And learned speeches. But we did not, I mean, there were Yiddish words and expressions, but it was not the lingua franca of our house. And that's another thing that separates kind of Orthodox Yeshiva Judaism from
right.
Hasidism, because contemporary Hasidim speak Yiddish.
Yeah, I mean, it's their first language. And we speak with, you know, Fahakta Yiddish, like a really kind of, I think there's, in Yiddish, there's, it's so funny because we are getting a little claustrophobically Jewish, aren't we?
I think so.
Because within Judaism, there are all the breaks. I mean, forget about all the sects within Hasidism and then all the different groups within Yeshivish or Misnagdish, i.e. the opposer Jews. But, you know, there's all that, those breakdowns. Then there's the popular ones that most people know about. There's the Orthodox, Conservative, Reform, and Reconstruction. Did I skip anything? I'm sure I did, right? There's so many flavors. Those are the, you know, but within Orthodoxy, there's ultra-Orthodoxy, and within ultra-Orthodoxy, there's Aguda slash Misnagdish slash Litvish, which literally means Lithuanian, doesn't
mm-hmm.
it? And then you have, under Hasidim, all those other breaks. So,
well, Hasidim are separated by their dynasties. You have Breslov, Bratslov,
right.
Tush, you know, Bels, Satmar, Babov. All those groups have specific rebbeim.
Which come from specific towns. That's what those names
exactly.
come from.
You know, Orthodox Judaism doesn't really have those kind of demarcations. I mean, yeah, there's modern Orthodox, ultra-Orthodox. I mean, that depends, like, how big your yarmulke is.
Yeshivish.
Whether you daven in a shul where women are separate. You know, well, most Orthodox
they
would.
All
but
daven in
how
a
high
shul.
The mechitza is.
Right.
I mean, the separation between men and women in the synagogue.
If your yarmulke is knitted.
Exactly.
If your hat has a bent down
exactly.
brim. Or if it's, like, more kind of cowboy-ass
what color
or
clothes
trilby-ish.
You wear.
What I mean, color clothes?
If you wear like black suit or dark suit and white shirt.
If you wear a tie
know,
or
that
not.
Means something, exactly.
And then
well,
with
clothes
women,
are always signifiers, I mean,
right.
and always have been.
Right. So there's the internal attitude of passion versus strenuousness around study. And then there's the external signals of where you belong in your community. And for women in particular, it's also, I mean, you know, although things are changing so dramatically, like you walk along the streets of Borough Park and I can't believe how sexy some of those outfits are. And that
well,
just
they're
not...
sexy, but they can't be revealing.
Right.
So you can be clingy, but you can't reveal flesh.
Well, you never, I mean, you couldn't be clingy, you know, back in the day when I was there.
Well, not super clingy, but...
It's shocking. Mm. I mean, wonderful. know, and the wigs, which are meant to like cover your hair so that you don't show your hair.
For married women only.
For married women only, make them even more sexy than, I mean, the stuff I go through with my hair. You know, some days I wonder if I should have just put the shaitel on, the wig on.
It would certainly make things a lot easier.
First, I have to find a chassan, a husband. Then I could throw one
on. So what are you looking for in a husband, Pearl?
Oh, my God. What am I looking for?
What's your dream, man?
You. Mwah. Mwah. But you have to switch sides. Or I can't even switch sides and be satisfactory enough for you.
You're not answering my question, my
dear. Oh, my God. I'm avoiding it. What am I looking for in a man? Let's see. Can I dream?
Dream. Okay. Go all out.
God, it's so boring. It's so typical.
You're tall, creating dark, a NERV handsome. Profile in the Soundcore story booth. Go with
I'm creating a Frumster profile. Now there's something called Saw You at Sinai, which I'm actually trying. What the hell? Why not? That's based on the whole, like, I should say, even not, it's not even a myth. It's in the Torah that we were all at Sinai. Was it Rashi? The commentary who says that we were all at Sinai and our souls were all there. We had all seen each other before. And we're just continuously, you know, Gilgalem, you know, the lost souls that keep coming back until Mashiach comes, until the Messiah comes. We're a highly messianic culture, aren't we? You know, maybe Mashiach will come when I get married. Maybe that's what we're all waiting for. My messianic match.
Everything but the qualities for your dream man.
I know. I'm avoiding. It's hard. It's easy. It's very easy and it's typical. Good sense of humor, a big heart. What is this turning into, like a personal ad? What are you looking for in a man?
I love how you just turn the question back on me without answering it at all.
Volleyball.
What is my dream man? My dream man is...
In uniform?
he can put one on every now and then, but probably not in one all the time.
Well, that would defeat the purpose.
Exactly.
Of accomplishing certain dreams or fantasies, more appropriately.
What is he? He's smart. Mm-hmm. He's literate. He's playful. He is patient. He's present. He is confident. But not arrogant. He is serene, but also capable of anger when needed.
Nice.
I think those were some things.
That's beautiful.
Thank you.
I wish that on you.
Well, thank you. I wish similar to you. I don't know exactly what you're looking for
still.
Well,
you got my juices flowing. Let's see. Along similar lines, but I think for me, probably someone who can do the kind of flirty, fun thing, likes being out there, but at the same time, probably a little more withdrawn than me, because that would just be, I don't know, either one's fine. I think respect, that's the most important thing, is mutual respect and honesty. Like, I think what I find most people are so afraid of doing is telling you what they're really thinking. And I think that when you know you're really connecting with someone, there's just a complete honesty that's fearless. Because you
someone
trust.
Who's not afraid.
And because you trust that what the other person is saying is not meant in a negative way. You believe that. So you're not afraid of saying what you're really thinking.
And someone who travels, perhaps. I know you traveled widely with your film, Divan.
Yeah. Yeah, traveling is... Someone's really, open. He could stay home with the kids. He doesn't have to travel with me. No, of course I want him to come with me.
Do you want to talk about your travels, traveling with your movie and where you've been? And...
It's actually even deeper than that, which I think you know. It's like the whole traveling thing might be a big element of why I veered or traveled from the world that I came from. You know, like leaving my Hasidish world, which I don't really think of as a departure. You know, there's a story about the Chafetz Chaim, how would you describe the Chafetz Chaim? Alive in the 1800s, a sage, right? Not a chassid. But in my lore, anyway, it was definitely part of my story, my Hasidic storybooks and so on. Anyway, he was the kind of guy who was always only with what he needed in life. And one of his students or contemporaries asked him, you know, why is it that you only have this one set of clothes or this, you know, we take care of you, we feed you, we give you enough money to live, you're our rabbi. Why are you living in such a humble environment? And he said, let me ask you something. When you go on a trip, Do you take all of your belongings, your furniture, your chandelier? Do you take your beautiful new, you know, tablecloth set and, you know, the doilies and all that, which, by the way, I have in my home, all the tablecloths and doilies and chandelier. You know, do you take that with you, or do you just take the belongings that you need? And when you come home, you're back home and you're in your surroundings. And of course, the student said, I take exactly what I need. And he said, well, that's me in this world. This is the world that takes me to the world to come. This is not home. And I think about that a lot, like that sense of, you know, which is funny because I'm such a pack rat and I love collecting things that used to belong to others in a way. So maybe it's not, it's within the same story, but I do think that I'm not ever home, you know, and that's not a bad thing. I find that that kind of displacement and that, for lack of a better term, marginality is what defines me. So that didn't make any sense in the Hasidic world that I was in at the time, which is also why I don't think I really left.
Well, what would home look like to you?
I'm not sure that home needs to look like anything. I think the continuous quest might be the home for me. And that's what I mean. Like, I don't think that that kind of searching or travel, you know, or, you know, flea marketing could be.
So you're saying you don't have a lot of heavy baggage?
I do, but I carry it with me. It could be heavier if I wasn't moving so much. So that's the good news.
Imagine what it would look like. Claim.
And I'm a Taurus.
It's there.
You know? It's funny because I'm a Taurus, which is meant to be like this kind of heavy, bullish presence. And I have that. But it's also ironically or maybe, you know, contrastingly light, you know, because. And so what I'm saying is I would never have fit in a world that is so deeply rooted, so deeply rooted. They're still wearing the clothes. The Hasidic people are still wearing the clothes of the 1800s of Polish nobility. I mean, it's so deeply rooted.
The men.
The men in particular, of course. And right, that hasn't moved. So for me, when I quote unquote left, it was mostly to just continue to move. And I couldn't continue to move in that world, you know.
But yet you do go back quite often.
Yeah, that's part of my movement. Mm-hmm. You know, I mean, oh God, it sounds pathetically wandering Jew-like.
The rootless people, the rootless cosmopolitans, as Stalin said.
Yes, that's us. Rootless cosmopolitans. Let's drink to that.
Mm.
I think we should sing to that. You know,
so,
it's,
go ahead.
What were you going to say?
When you go back, what's it like for you? When you go back into the Hasidic world, when you go for Yanta, for the holidays?
It confirms how much I don't belong, which, as we just said earlier, is partly home-like for me.
Mm-hmm.
It's okay. It was really rough in the beginning, and, you know, I have to attribute the comfort to my family because they've just remained so open and wonderful. And I think it's because they're finally, and through my film, which they were very afraid of because it was so open, about I critically but lovingly looked at the world that I came from or come from, and they were so worried that that was, and as was I, that that was going to create a serious divide between us. And in the end, I think it brought us closer. Which just goes to show you what I said earlier, the honesty. You know, like not being afraid to be honest about what really is going on because look what might happen. And it was amazing. I mean, it just brings tears to my eyes thinking about it. So when I go back, it reminds me of that and it gives me the strength to meet people who are still operating on a different level, very judgmental, very superficial, seeing me with my crazy hair or whatever it is or my, you know, inappropriate glasses.
Your hair's looking surprisingly tame today.
Yeah, that might be your effect on me. Mm. Like I said, Vilna go into the Hasidim, errant to pearl.
Mm.
To tame the Hasidic shrews. That's us. Mm. The madness. God, I did always like Austin's Mad Woman in the Attic. I always related to that mad woman. I mean, who doesn't? Right? Sometimes I wanted the husband.
Mm.
Too. Anyway, so back to the perfect man, if there is such a thing, it would be someone who could, as you said, travel with me, but not in a literal get on airplane way, but like kind of might feel the same way about like the lines between things.
Mm-hmm.
You know, who draws them, like looking into who draws those lines and why they're drawn in the first place, and then just in enjoying them or refuting them if necessary. You know, so, and I think you function in that world too. You're someone who's very disciplined. Like in my mind, you're very disciplined, and yet you keep crossing that line.
What's the line that I cross?
All of them. Like you don't, you continuously surprise me.
Mm. Yeah. How do I do that?
Because you, it seems like you live in this very specific way. Like you're very disciplined. to me. I mean, you know, compared to me. And, you know, you do your work. You have an amazing career, having gone from, like, YIVO, which is, like, your love is Yiddish, and gone to, like, the New York Public Library and done your work there. And then, like, you're at the Library of Congress. You know, you move to Washington. You leave your urban love, you know, New York, where there's so many, like, intricacies that you can relate to. And you go to Washington, which is devoid or seems to be devoid of that.
It's not entirely devoid, and it certainly has its own charms.
Like?
Well, it's very green.
Mm-hmm.
And it's the design of the city by L'Enfant is really quite beautiful. And there is something very noble and inspiring about these grand governmental edifices, you know, these just marble buildings that really represent the best of our country.
Mm-hmm.
Whether we live up to them and actually fulfill those democratic ideals is another question, but just to actually experience, you know, just kind of feel what our founding fathers dreamed of. I think some of those, it's in the air in Washington. Of course, the other reality is this incredible divide between rich and poor.
Mm-hmm.
That's really quite stark once you leave the governmental areas. And but Washington does have these little pockets of things. You know, these sort of quirky neighborhoods. Duke Ellington was born there. There is a sense of richness. It's not always easy to access, but certainly it lacks the kind of vibrancy and the ethnic diversity of New York.
You know,
people go to New York to fulfill their dream, you know, to really make something happen. New York, it's not about where you come from. It's about what your project is. Who are you? What are you trying to accomplish?
Mm-hmm.
DC is less of that, where you come from and what you're doing. And it's, you have to kind of constantly prove yourself in DC in a way.
Did you come to New York for that reason?
I fell in love with New York. I came to New York to study Yiddish. I was in Atlanta at Emory University. Someone had told me about the Yiddish program that's co-sponsored by, at that time it was co-sponsored by Columbia and the YIVO Institute for Jewish Research.
Mm-hmm.
And now it is co-sponsored by NYU and YIVO. And I studied Yiddish for 2 years, and then I worked on the summer program for 2 years as the assistant to the director, and then I kind of moved into YIVO itself, into the library. Well, first in the archives, then the library. And just fell in love with it as a kind of amazing cosmic place to occupy. YIVO was founded in 1925, I believe, in Vilna, which then was Poland and now is Vilnius in Lithuania, and was founded as kind of a Jewish new school for social research, essentially. There were quotas in universities and Jewish students couldn't get in, and there was a need to train graduate students in the Jewish social sciences. And so that's what YIVO became, and then it gradually built up this archives and library to support the research that was going on. And during the war, what was then the American branch became the headquarters, as it was very clear that the decimation to come was going to be quite, you know, quite far-reaching. And so the main branch of YIVO was moved to New York. And so I worked at YIVO for some, I guess, on and off for like 9 years.
Right. And now you're...
different departments.
I mean, I just listened to your career. That's what I was saying earlier. And you'd think your father would be like incredibly proud of his son.
Well, all my accomplishments are, to the extent that we can even call them accomplishments, are peripheral.
I think here we can call them accomplishments.
I mean, I think they're peripheral. I feel very blessed and fortunate. I love what I do. But for my father, it's about keeping Shabbos and being a Torah observant Jew. You know, that's, you know, forget like being a Rebbe or whatever, just basic. He would be really happy with just being basic.
Oh, and if you'd only marry a woman, that would be nice.
A woman would be great. It doesn't matter that I'm gay. It doesn't matter at all. It's like, just marry a woman. A man has to be with a woman. It doesn't really matter what you do in the bedroom. You can, you know.
We should just get married. Make everybody happy.
I think so. I think we'd be like the ultimate beard, you know, the ultimate front marriage. I think it'd be really cool.
No, the ultimate front marriage, dear, is if you were wealthy. Unfortunately, you come from a poverty-stricken Jewish family.
Yes.
Which there's a whole other thing that you're not even, we haven't even touched on, which is like your amazing work in, you know, your political work and your connection to issues of poverty, specifically even Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
You know, people don't imagine Jews as poor Jews.
Right.
You know,
right.
The stories you tell me are amazing. I mean, I certainly wasn't brought up in the lap of luxury either, but, you know, the one thing, you know, in the Hasidic world, or at least Borough Park and also Williamsburg, is we definitely care for our people. So, you know, along the lines of you having to at least marry a woman so it looks right, it looked right. Everyone was taken care of. But the stories you tell me just blow my mind, you know, about that. Not that
we were never hungry, but, you know, my father's a yeshiva rebbe, so how much does yeshiva rebbe make? And to support five children and to, you know, it's just very, very little. So the material was never, you know, kind of a main, material comfort was not like sort of in my background at all.
And well, it's not even in the tradition either, material comfort.
Well, but it's interesting how in the outside world there's this assumption that Jew equals middle class.
Correct.
And particularly in the leftist circles that I moved in for many years, it's, you know, you talk about like sort of race, class, gender, like those are the, you know, the central yeah. tropes. And, well, you know, where did the Jews fit in? You know, do Jews fit into like this sort of simplistic multicultural triad? And, you know, they really don't on
right.
some level. And the fact that Jews are poor is something, that the fact that there even are poor Jews is not something that's really talked about in any sort of meaningful way or even that, you know.
Not in the secular Jewish world or the cultural Jewish world, but certainly in our religious backgrounds. It's talked about all the time.
Yeah, yeah. But
it's almost
not,
glorified.
It's not perceived as like a kind of readily apparent trope. You know,
right.
like we have to get our poor Jews in to make this a representational panel, you know, or any event. Because it's not really talked about.
We're really uncomfortable yeah. around money. Jews are very uncomfortable talking about money.
Yeah.
And that might fit into that. And again, I say in the world, outside of the world I come from, and I think the world you come from too. Because in our world, we're always talking about ways in which you can be powerful in the community and with the important pillars of life. You know, Gemilas Chasadim. What is it again? It's Torah, Avodah, and Gemilas Chasadim.
Ashash Dvarim Ha'olam Omed. On three things the world stands.
On Torah, on the study of Torah.
Avodah is prayer, and Gemilas Chasadim is kindness, good deeds.
Right. And those do revolve around money, in that you support those who sit and learn, or you're someone who sits and learns, and you get supported. They don't only revolve around money,
no.
but that
Gemilas
discussion
Chasadim is
takes
just helping,
place.
Helping people, helping poor.
Right.
And that's something, the focus on staka, on yeah. righteousness
charity.
And charity is something that the left sometimes seizes upon when it tries to create a specifically Jewish leftist.
But it is interesting to me, and I think about this a lot with you and me, like, you know, your departure from that world, and we've already established how different those worlds are, but still there are similarities in the fact that they're both ultra-Orthodox and very faith-based. And your departure from that world is like, without trying to categorize it too much, was kind of political and kind of...
It was.
Yeah. And mine was very much based on the kind of art, you know, trying to express myself in truth.
It was emotional, too. I mean, I knew that as a gay person, I would never fit in. It was just absolutely undoable. Like, there was no question. Like,
and I don't see you as someone who's trying to make your identity fit into Orthodoxy. I see you as trying to make your identity be what it is and remain what you consider Jewish.
I don't really believe in the divide between secular and religious. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think I like to see it more as a continuum. And I don't identify as secular Jew in the way that, you know, the Jewish labor bund in the 19th century and 20th century was trying to create a secular Yiddishkeit, you know, a weltliche Yiddishkeit. I don't really see myself as...
No.
That's not my background.
I don't see
claim
you as a secularist
that.
Either.
I don't... No, I'm actually interested in religion and I'm interested in, you know, the impulse towards religion that moves people, you know, and what happens later, you know, how religion is often used to separate people and create, you know, terrible wars and bloodshed is kind of a horrific result. But the actual impulse towards, you know, seeking that something greater, I think is ultimately a noble one.
Yeah. And what's interesting is that and this is what I meant earlier about more of your discipline, like, and ironically, in a way, you are very much more Gemara than Agudah. You know, Agada, you know, someone who's much more interested in the kind of religious / legalistic reality. And me, I'm like always caught up in the stories and also not trying to recreate out here, you know, something new or ardently secular or something different than the world I came from. It's more about looking back, you know, like Lot's wife and not being afraid to turn to salt, looking back and bringing in to the world that I have today what I have from the world that I came from. And in my way, I think I cross lines almost as a rule. And it just seems like our conversation is always we slip into each other's anyway. Mm-hmm. And that's what I meant by the fact that it seems like you're almost, you do cross those lines, and it just seems like you might not, but you do, and you go there. And I think you have to, by virtue of being, as you said earlier, marginal mm-hmm. in your world. You know, you have to be then the storyteller sometimes.
And one of the things that you and I have talked about is how in the Jewish world we're seen as either not Jewish or traitors yeah. or betrayers.
It's so ironic.
But in the non-Jewish world, you know, we're seen as too Jewish. Right. Our work is too Jewish. It's, as you said earlier, claustrophobically Jewish.
Yeah.
Do you want to talk about that?
I don't know. Do I get Jewish the BBC? Do I get the BBC into trouble? I do think, and that's where I was headed in a way, like, you know, ironically, we both have the father figure in common where, you know, our fathers don't necessarily see us as Jewish enough in the outside world. I mean, definitely don't see us as Jewish enough in the, you know, where we are today. And then where we are today, those people around us see us as too Jewish, you know. And, you know, the film that I had done, which is about how I reconnect with my father, or try to, through the story of my great-grandfather's couch, you know, that story, you know, is meant to draw me closer to my father. And yeah, it's the Hasidic community that I base it in, but it could be any community. And, you know, I was told it's too Jewish or claustrophobically Jewish. And, you know, that reminded me of that. But I think in that spirit of being claustrophobically Jewish, we should keep Shabbos. And today is Shabbos. So maybe we should have a little Shabbos moment, and you can read me from your poem called Chalant. And then maybe we can sing a song if there's time to still do that.
As I get bubblegum on my book.
You're like those hot Yiddish backup girls and take the bubblegum out of their mouth and put it on the mic.
Chalant, you must note the perfect pallor of those potatoes, the persistent wink of the yam, the round green of the outer onion, the cloves that traveled far from the caves of former colonies to seduce the most elusive of flanks, the list that cannot explain the way the chef was driven, the whimsical grin of the divine.
Amen. And that's from your book, The Insatiable Psalm, that just came out, didn't it?
Yes, it did.
Should we sing?
I would love to sing.
It's Shabbos.
It
what do we
Shabbos.
Sing? By the way, I must warn you that I think I have a different tune than you do for almost everyone. So
I thought there was some that we shared, but I can't
oh,
really
honey,
remember.
Deeply we share everything. Let's face it. We just harmonize. We don't share. Do we need to share? Can't we just harmonize?
Should we do Dror Yikra?
See, we don't do that.
How do you do it?
It's just easier.
Let's go there.
Plus less words. You know, since you're a busy farmer, you don't have time. How about another song?
Okay. Too hard?
I don't know, because it wasn't one of my favorites.
How about Yom Zemechuba?
I love Yom Zemechuba. Okay, let's do that one. So
doesn't
it come before the Chalant? Chalant is that bean dish that you serve on Shabbos afternoon. It's like a chili. But I'll sing it with you.
Go ahead. What's yours?
Yom Zemechibad Mikal Yamim Kivay Shabbos Tzurai Lamim Let the record show I'm off book. And you have to picture, as Aaron will continue singing, you have to picture the whole family sitting around and singing, even the girls. And then you can smell the chalant wafting in. Beautiful. I love that song.
It's really beautiful.
Well, we
so
could
end
in one more.
Way.
Do you know Baruch Kel Elyon?
Baruch
oh, I love that song.
Kel Elyon.
Baruch Kel Elyon, Asher Nasan Menichu, Linaf Shaini Pidyon, Misayis Anochu, V'yayif Lai Letziyon,
Iyir Hanit. You read it. I'll just like.
This is hard.
I'll just kind of moan.
This is all bringing back our childhood memories.
Sort of
by the
like
way, we just moved backward into.
Generic davening.
We moved backward. We moved into Friday night, right before the chicken soup comes in, and after the gefilte fish. Or, by the way, gefilte fish is such in a way, a cultural piece of package. It's a package of information for us. People don't realize that. It's, you know, a lot of these cult, you know, the Ashkenazic world that comes from that area, we're not really living near huge bodies of water to be able to get enough fish for Shabbos, right? You're supposed to have Basar V'Dagim, meat and fish. And since they couldn't do it, they had to come up with an alternative. And so you have what's called falsha fish, which is actually false fish, which is made of chicken, or gefilte fish, which is this mush that just makes it last longer. Plus, fish is expensive. In fact, it's still expensive. Should we have Baruch Kelelion?
Sure.
Do we have time for...
And then
for...
we can talk about you being a fag hag.
I am not a fag hag. It's just you.
Oh, please, Paul. Come on.
You are my fag hag.
You're so outsized. So you have all this grandeur that gay men love and straight men are fear.
Oh, you're so beautiful. Thank you, honey. That's just an indication of why we're so close. He just keeps making me feel good. Keep it coming. I think it's the fact that I collect, you know, secondhand everything, you know, and I just, I'm expressive.
You're a gleaner.
I'm a gleaner. I'm so inspired by that movie, by the way. Agnes Varda's The Gleaners and I is one of my favorite. Fireman's Ball, Milos Forman, just appreciating the everyday. That's why I became an ethnographer and then said, academia? What? Where's a camera? Make me a filmmaker. All right, here we go. Last song. Should we do it?
Do it.
Baruch Kel Elyon, Asher Nasan, Menichu, Linaf Shaini, Pidyon, Mishas, Vianuchu, Viedrash, Letzion. You're not singing.
It's your solo moment, baby.
Adonu teganefesh anuchu ashaimer shabbos habeinim habas le'al yiritzai kiminchu amachvas yashlai kochoiche. You know
this
song.
This is the knee slapping part.
That's right. It's actually inspired by the alcohol you were drinking for Kiddush or after Kiddush. You guys didn't get drunk like we did, did you?
We didn't.
Oh yeah, we did. Wow. The men's section, always. The men's section would have like the whiskeys and the better alcohol, which I'm not trying to gender bend, but that's really where I veer towards. The women's section would have those awful cherry and banana liquors. I'm like, who are you kidding?
Right.
Give me the good stuff.
Girl drinks.
By the way, that's something my father and I, like, we have so little in common, but that's something like, you know.
So you bond over alcohol?
He gets me, whiskey and I get him. I was just in Scotland and I brought him back a bottle of scotch. You know what I'm saying?
It's the hard-drinking Gluck family.
There's no coincidence that I called my company Palinka Pictures after the Hungarian brandy. Listen, you got to know what works.
You like to party hardy.
In the right situation, not in that, well, nothing ever in that typical way. I think I could say the same of you. I know you're not a night person, but you do know how to party. You could dance it up like the rest of them.
I do love to dance.
You do.
So. I love dancing at your... your Divan premiere party. That was a really special moment for me.
Or my vodka really latke parties. That's claustrophobically Jewish.
That was very claustrophobic. It's like 200 people fit into a tiny room.
Well, I think we have to end.
Yeah.
Good Shabbos,
so
Arla.
Much. Good Shabbos, Perl.
Do you hear my stomach growling? It's time for lunch.
It's time for challenge.
It's time for challenge. Mwah.
Mwah. That was lovely.
We'll talk soon.
Okay.